So, today we're going to the country, to a house which has hosted many fascinating artistic people. And the house has its own very own personality. It's in the heart of Dorset, a county which some claim to be the beginning of the West Country. The house is in a valley within valleys where the stars shine brightly and the deer wander freely. This house was home to one of the most famous society photographers of the 20th century, Cecil Beaton. It then changed hands to a countryman. Then in 1992, by chance, Antoinette Parks found the house and restored it to its glory. The house is Ashcombe. Sadly, Antoinette does not live there any longer. It was sold to Guy Ritchie and Madonna. Tony is here to talk about her stunning coffee table book, Ashcombe Revisited. Hi, Tony. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello.
So, why is Ashcombe so enchanting?
I think because it's in the most remarkable valley. You go down the valley from the top and you think you've reached the bottom. You come to this little arch and you look through the arch and there's this little box sitting opposite you. But when you get to the house, the valley goes on so that you have this... It's like living in a sort of treehouse. You're looking at treetops and the most fantastic view. And it's just an enchanting looking house, pale brick with lots of lichen on it. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, but you describe it as green, some of the brickwork. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's for the houses around us. Mm. And the house that we restored first, because when we approached the old man, we were amazingly lucky to discover it, who lived there. He wanted to stay there. But he did eventually let us restore a derelict cottage in the valley, and that's made of what's called greenstone, which is a very, very pale grey stone, but when it rains it takes on various lichen colours. It's quite beautiful, and it's very much all over that part of Dorset.
It's kind of like flint, isn't it?
Well, you can get flint mixed in with it. Flint and brick is very much in the sort of arts and crafts style, but the actual stone isn't like flint, although I suppose it's grey.
Okay, so tell us, you've told us about the setting, can you describe the house more? So what is the brick? Is it a red brick?
It's a very red brick, not a very red brick, it's a pale red brick, and it's a square house with a pediment on the top. And Cecil Beaton got Rex Whistler to design the front door made of bar stone, which is beautiful and rather sort of embellishes the whole house. It's square, with square windows on two floors, and then a stone coin on the top of each window. And the windows are a sort of octagonal pane, which is rather pretty. They were blown out in the war when a bomb dropped on the little cottage that we restored, came up, hit the coach house, which was opposite the house, and knocked all the windows out except for two. Beaton painted on the octagonal windows, but when we got there, we cleaned them all off and stuck lead on both sides and then painted the outside, which is, they were always painted in cream. So they're rather beautiful little windows.
So is it Georgian, the house?
Well, I don't... It's Georgian in style, but the original house was a much bigger house there, and this little house was always there, and the coach house was built in the 17th century. So it's incredibly classical for that time. Whether or not somebody slightly Georgianised it, I don't know. I don't know. Nobody knows what it was built for, because it was separate from the very big house, which was rather French-looking and very grand, and they think possibly our little house was either the wash house or the cook house, because when we were restoring it, one of the many ceilings came down and there was huge great lead ceiling that ran the whole width of the house, which I would imagine is either to prevent steam or fire. So I don't know what it was built for, but it's quite classical looking.
Amazing. So is the setting perfect?
Well, I thought so, yes. Didn't really have a garden, and it was sitting on a very narrow terrace, which Beaton built, two narrow terraces, but when you stood on them, you stood in a straight line outside the house and you couldn't really sit down. And Georgia Langton, who designed the garden for me, told me to double the width so that the house then sat on a plinth as if it wasn't tumbling down the valley. And she did a very, very simple garden, because she said, you don't need a garden with a view like this.
Yes, because in a way the garden's bigger than the house,
yes,
isn't it? The view's bigger than the house, so it takes away. Mm. You don't want to take away from the view, do you?
And also it had, it's below it too, it's got the most lovely old kitchen garden, which obviously, which is vast, it must be about 2 acres, if not more, which obviously was a kitchen garden to the big house. And that's lovely brick too. And it had a grotto and lots of wonderful things, but the grotto's slightly gone.
That's what I want to ask. Did Cecil Beaton leave his mark? I mean, obviously, the old man had been in there. What condition was it in?
It was in terrible condition, because Beaton was only 24, I think, when he got there. And he was amazing to even take it on at that age. He wasn't.
Yes.
And he restored it on a budget, which was a shoestring. Mm. So it was all very basically restored. And he put one bathroom downstairs, I don't think there was one up, restored the coach house, which is opposite, and I think when Mr. Borley evicted him, well, his lease came to an end, and Beaton always thought he was evicted and hated him for it, I don't think he changed it. Beaton did the front door, because Rex Whistler was his friend. The kitchen was very basic, and you could only get to the back of the house where the drawing room was through a tiny little narrow passage.
So it isn't a grand house, is it?
No.
No.
There's no fireplaces, there's no cornices.
Maybe it was just built for entertaining, like, you know how quite often, like, Chiswick House was made. You know, the Dukes never stayed there. They just used it for picnics.
I don't think so, because I think up until that time, the big house was always used. Mm. And that was only pulled down because nobody was living in it. Not, you know, because it was too expensive, I presume. And it was stopped being pulled down, which is why my house and the coach house is still there, because the trucks, carts going up the drive were damaging the roads in the neighbourhood area, not because it was a beautiful building being put down. So my house, I think, was left there by accident. And it's far too small for that area to be used as a house, really. I mean, I think it's quite big. And most.
How many bedrooms is it?
It had, in the end, 6 bedrooms. Mm. 1, 2, yeah, 6 bedrooms. Mm. One was a dressing room.
So tell us what Cecil Beaton did do some art on the walls. Can you tell us about that?
In the main room, which is the main bedroom, he made it into a circus room, and he painted, what do they call those, poles that you have in circuses.
Circus poles.
Circus poles, all over the walls, and then there was wonderful horse, a lady with riding side saddle on a horse, and various other things, making it all a theme of circus. It was painted by a group of his friends, and it was a rainy day, so he decided that he would paint the circus room, which was his bedroom. So they all did, and some were good and some were appalling. And Rex Whistler, at the end of the day, said, look, I can't leave it like this, it's a mess. I'm going to pull it all together. And Beaton said, you can't, they'll know. And he said, oh, don't be so silly, they'll never come back. And so he transformed all the ugly paintings into much more beautiful things and made it really fun. Unfortunately, one of the guests, I think it was Bismarck, decided to show off his handiwork, as it were, to his house party the next weekend, and they all came over and saw the room not as they'd left it, and they were very upset. But Beaton loved it, and he made a four-poster bed and kept all the paintings, and it's a fabulous room, and he made a very big window at the back of the house so that you look down this fantastic valley.
But when you arrived, the frieze wasn't there, was it?
No. Borley hated Beaton. I don't know if he disliked the notoriety of Beaton or...
Maybe he was gay or...
Yes, yeah. Well, Borley was gay.
And was he?
Yes, and perhaps it was unrequited love, I don't know.
Wow.
But anyway, he didn't like Beaton, and he never allowed Beaton to come back to Ashcombe or any of his friends, and he closed it down totally. And... you know, I can't remember what your question was.
Did he cover the walls?
Oh, yes, he covered everything else. Downstairs in the bathroom, where the Beaton asked all his guests to put their hands on the wall, which he then traced, and they signed their name in the middle of the hand, from Salvador Dali, Greta Garbo, everybody, all the local nobs in the county and all the film stars and people that came there. And anyhow, Borley, unfortunately, put sort of eggshell on that, so we couldn't get that back. But he only papered over some of the drawings in the circus room. And so when we got there, the builder, very brilliantly, started soaking off the paper. And we found about three of the paintings underneath, which was terribly exciting.
So did you just kind of, you and then were they restored on top? Was it like, did he put a glaze on it or something?
No,
so
he left them. They were only, I think, in watercolours, so they wouldn't look right if they'd had a sort of sheen on them. Mm. And they, one or two of them were really quite clear. And actually, so was the dappled horse. That was quite clear,
lovely.
Yes.
Lovely, so, so charming. So, why did you have to have the house? Because that's one of the main themes that runs through the book, you know, that your obsession was getting this house.
Well, I'd never heard about it, and I hadn't read the book about Beaton. And when we first found out that half the farm was going to be sold, and we went there and there to look for it, and I didn't know there was a house there at all, but I said to the farm managers who was showing us where the boundaries were, it's quite a large amount of land, I think it was about 750 acres, with no house on it. Isn't there a manor house somewhere? And his wife said, oh, yes, there is. Mr. Cecil Beaton used to live there, and he wrote a book about it. And I thought, God, this is exciting. So I asked about Mr. Borley and discovered he was very old and he didn't see anybody and he wasn't married and didn't have any heirs, as far as I knew. And so I said to David, let's go and try and find it, because it must be beautiful. And it took us an hour to find, and we were on the farm. And all I could see across a valley eventually was a sort of white roof, and I couldn't understand why was it white, but I just thought, that is in the most beautiful position of any house I've ever seen. And I fell in love with where it was, I think. I'd never seen it.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing. So, I loved your writing, and there's some wonderful descriptions of the countryside. May I read out a little passage? It's page 98 here. I'm going to read it. Rain had turned the valley bottom into a wide green river of grass, in contrast to the downs, which are the colour of ripe corn. The trees are beginning to lose their looks, and like the downs, have become blousy and overblown. The hills are strangely sensual, resembling fat Rubens women with thick thighs, breasts and buttocks lying on their sides. From afar, you'd want to stroke them. And this is your diary.
But the lovely thing about all those downs in that part of Wiltshire, they're just like Rubens.
They have curves, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, aren't they? There's no jagged edges. Mm. They're beautiful.
Mm. 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 So these are... Tell me about your diaries. So you were writing at the same time. Why did that happen? Do you always write a diary?
Well, I'd done quite a bit of sort of building in London, restoration work, and I always found that it's quite useful if I keep a record of what it was. And I'd always done it with the same builder, who was a friend as well, but it just jog my memory about what happened. And also, because Beaton had written a book about it, not that I ever thought I'd write the book, I just thought it'd be quite fun for somebody else to know how we found it, how we got it, what was going on. And of course, once I'd started, it was really rather a, you know, thing. And then when I didn't know we were going to leave, I asked this mountain photographer called John Clare to come and photograph all the valleys throughout the farm, which it's riddled with valleys. It's about 1,200 acres, and it's the most beautiful. You don't see a pylon, a road, or anything. And he did these, and I said, can you do them out throughout the year? So I had winter, spring, you know, or summer, autumn. And I said, stupidly, don't worry about the house, I've got lots of them. But he disobeyed me, which was a relief. And I had these, when I left, I had these wonderful photographs. And I was going to give them to my husband, but as he decided he was going to go around the world or up to Scotland, neither of which I wanted, I thought I'd keep them. So I had these amazing, amazing, beautiful photographs. And I thought these ought to be published. And I couldn't think how, and I suddenly remembered my diary. So I put them together, and then luckily Hugo Vickers, Beaton's biographer, was encouraging and introduced me to Tom Perrin, who is just a remarkable person, and he said, yes, I think we, you know, he had a brilliant editor, and Louise, and she really sort of pulled my rather bad writing properly together and put the pictures in. And it's entirely due to them that it got together.
Well, it is fantastic, but I don't want to end there because I want to just talk about, it wasn't an easy thing at all doing up this house. Partly health reasons, partly, as you say, I mean, it wood beetle, ceilings collapsing. It wasn't a normal size of house, so it's like, how do things fit in? I mean, there were so many dramas, weren't there?
There were, but I had then a wonderful builder, and he and I worked very well together, and he just got on with it. I mean, there's a bit in the book about the Death Watch beetle.
Yes, that was shocking.
And anyhow, he'd given us a quote for it, and he went and saw the various people who deal with Death Watch beetle, and they said, well, when they'd looked at the house, and they said to Steve, the builder, well, this'll be 50,000 for you. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, they won't know how much it's going to cost, and it's riddled and it looks ghastly. And Steve turned around and said, I give them a quote of 3,000 and I'll stick to that, thank you. And in fact, it isn't so desperate as everybody says it is, because they like oak, mm-hmm. which is wonderful. But if you cut out the oak and replace it with pine, which of course doesn't last as long, but they don't eat the pine, so they go away.
So they're pine-averse. Mm. That's a very useful thing to remember.
Yes, it is, actually.
Now, you've talked about your garden designer, but you also had a friend that was an interior designer who came and gave you advice as well.
Well, I was incredibly lucky. I am incredibly lucky. A friend of mine called Hugh Henry, who's a partner of David Milinarix, who I think is one of the finest interior decorators there is. And he was absolutely wonderful. He helped me with the colours, and if there was any question where should the layout go, because we knocked down a partition wall which opened up the whole hall, and that was partly him telling us what to do, and I didn't know where to put the kitchen. And actually he and Georgia Langton, who did the garden together, were much more brilliant than I in mapping it out, and he chose his wonderful colours.
And yes, he went for a very neutral palette, which wasn't that fashionable then. Yes. The colours he chose then are really in now, yes. Kind of sage greens, donkey brown, off-whites, grey. Grey. I was surprised to see grey then.
Yeah. And I just think he's the most amazing man. And he actually, what we did in the end was getting it back to, because I don't know if it was ever a house that was lived in, but it was certainly the kitchen, which we turned into the hall. Was the focus of the house, and probably always was, because the wall that they'd put up was just a partition wall and sitting on the stone floor. So when we lifted it up...
So was the hallway, was it somewhere you could kind of hang out in, did it? You know what I mean?
Well, we didn't, in fact, but you could have done. It was big enough. I think David had his desk in there, but that was it. And then Hugh said bookshelves around the edge, so it was very simple. And he was quite relieved that there wasn't too much of the 1930s there. So, because the one and only bathroom upstairs was bright pink, which I don't know, presumably that was a Beaton addition. I don't know.
Well, yeah, because in the 30s, my granny had a house and it was pink, the bathroom. I loved it.
Yes.
It was pink and green.
Yes,
I really
exactly.
liked it. Yeah. But I don't know whether he was going for that look. I think he was going for more minimal. Now, I want to, you know the names of flowers, trees, birds, animals. How do you, Tony, know so much about nature?
I don't know. And also, I keep forgetting, I have to look them up the whole time. I think I've got very good advisors. Georgia Langton, who was just amazing with the garden and made it very basic. So I just did what she told me to do. I've always lived in the country, though, and always had lovely gardens. My sister is an amazing gardener and has a fantastic...
So do you think you sort of learnt on the way?
Yes, totally.
Never trained. Mm. But that's why your descriptions are lovely, because you can really describe the countryside.
Oh, nice.
Really impressed, because I don't know the name for slowly, it's like me, I'm slowly learning. Now, tell us about shooting there, because obviously that is really important to the house.
Well, we had to make the place pay for itself, and the farming, because it was downland, was useless. I mean, and sheep, I didn't think at that time were making much money. That was all we could put on it. And David's always loved shooting, always had a shoot. And the valleys are fantastic. They are really close together. The contour map looks like a thumbprint. The valleys, the lines are so close together, and there must be about six really high valleys. And it was a way of actually making everything work and making the shoot pay for itself. Although shooting is amazing, it costs an awful lot to rent a day. You don't make really any money out of the actual shoot. It broke even, despite
the
fact.
What do you make money out of?
Having people to stay.
Wow. What, because they pay to stay? Or?
Yep, they pay to stay. And when we restored the coach house, it meant we had another six bedrooms there, so everybody could stay. I had the most amazing friend, cook, called Victoria Blashford Snell, the explorer's daughter, who was local to that area, and she did all the shoot. I didn't even ask her what we were having. I knew it was going to be delicious.
That's such a relief, not having to think about menus.
Exactly. She was absolutely amazing. We never had the same thing unless it was so good. And I said, please, can we have that again? And then I had a lovely team of local girls who helped with changing the beds and that sort of thing. And we shot Mondays and Tuesdays, so the weekends were free. And it was fascinating. I loved it. We met, because it was one of the best, David did turn it into one of the best shoots in England. It was voted by Field, and goodness knows how many is the best shoot, because the birds were really, really high. And they didn't come in huge flushes. They came as if they were coming singly. So it didn't look commercial. And we had wonderful people. And if it was a commercial day taken by, say, a bank or something, they always bought their best customers. So that I met the most fascinating people because they were the best customers of Klein Wartz or whoever it was. And it was riveting. I loved it.
Lovely.
I did the ironing.
Well, you're always, in fact, I was very good to read because you're always doing housework. And since I've been reading the book, I'm thinking, well, Tony did housework, so I can do it because I'm very much a housework avoider. Can you explain to listeners who don't know about shooting that you're not actually shooting rare wild birds?
No, you put down, we didn't rear our own pheasants or partridges, and they weren't English partridges, they were French partridges, and we bought them in as day-old chicks, and the keepers then put them into big release pens around the farm, and when they were mature, they were released, and they were fed every evening, so that they stayed on the farm. And then on a shoot day, the beaters, which are a line of men, used to drive them into an area, then drive the birds from the top of one valley to another with the guns standing at the bottom, and lots of pickers up, so that we picked up all the wounded birds, if there were any, hopefully weren't, and then they were sold to a game dealer. So there was nothing that was precious, and I refused.
And also the food, a game dealer means that it's going to be eaten.
Yes.
All these birds are eaten.
And I also said I didn't want woodcock shot because we had woodcock, because they could only come over to breed, and they're lovely little birds.
I love them.
And so I wouldn't allow those to be shot, or hares.
Oh, wonderful.
Because hares can be so easily wounded. And then you know, it's ghastly. So no hares, no woodcock, just the pheasants and the partridges.
That's marvellous. So how many years in the end were you at Ashcombe?
Sadly, only for 10, but it was a magic 10 years, and it's not an old people's house, so perhaps I'd have had to move anyway.
So your husband made a very big, he wanted a life change, maybe he was having a midlife crisis, as we all do at times.
I think so, yes.
So he wanted to change, he wanted to move. Now, you got some very interesting owners. How did Guy Ritchie and Madonna hear about it? Obviously, I know that Guy loves shooting.
Well, it was put on the market by Savills, I think it was. I think it was Savills. And so we got a lot of people of interest, actually. I mean, Tim Rice came. I made him a very good offer, actually. he was dithering over it. And I really wanted him to have it because he had a lovely family and I would have liked it to be a family home. So his son was shooting with us one day and I said to him, will you tell Dad that he can have Ashcombe half price, but I come too? But unfortunately, he turned me down. So Guy and Madonna came. She, I think, was a great fan of Cecil Beaton's. And so she liked that connection, and Guy liked shooting. and they were the ones that bought it. And he's still there, and I think he loves it.
Well, I think that's a marvellous thing. Knowing that he's passionate about shooting, you know, is keeping it going. So I lived in Dorset at the actual time when Madonna bought it. And the gossip that I kind of got came to me was things like, Madonna's put out a message, where can she get organic vegetables? I remember this message all went round, but it was so hard in those days to get organic vegetables. But then I had a friend that went round there and she came and said, Madonna's got a black Christmas tree this year, you know, and I was like so impressed, you know. But also I remember hearing that they were upset because there was some sort of pathway that the public could go through, and they wanted to stop it because obviously lots of people came to try and spy. Do you know where the path is?
Yes, and it actually wasn't ever really that near the house, and you couldn't see the house from it. I think they were just a bit paranoid that kidnapping and all that sort of thing. There was a rup above the house which vehicles could go down, but you couldn't get to the house that way. And there was only one footpath which started at Wynne Green, which is a sort of pre-druid burial ground on the right on the top of the farm, and it went down the valley below the house and then past, and it was only one. I don't think that, you know, that a lot of those people want to fence off everything. And
did they win, or can people still walk there?
I think they can still walk there.
Good. I'm really pleased that normal, common people are allowed to walk through the countryside.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very, very important. So, Tony, what's your favourite memory of Ashcombe?
I think the first time I saw it, because I'd fallen in love with this glimpse across the valley and hadn't seen it and was quite determined to get it without knowing what it looked like. And we were taken there by the farm manager to meet Mr. Borley, who was really going to interview us to see if we were the right sort of people, to buy then only half the farm. But we'd always had this idea that when he died, he might then sell us that. And you come down this very steep drive and you come to this arch. And in fact, it then had some wrought-on gates closed. So I walked the other end of the coach house, which is what the back of this was, and turn the corner and then look down at this little house. And when I say little, it's quite big from the average house in England, but it's little compared to a grand house. And I just thought, this is amazing. It was at the end of a lawn with wonderful huge ilex trees round it, and it was just so pretty and such a lovely place.
Ashcombe Revisited is published by Zuleika and available on Amazon. For more amazing interviews, go to radiogorgeous.com. Tony, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you for having me.